This meeting of the Senate Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will come to order. We have one bill on the agenda, Senate File 2. And because it's a long bill and a lot in it, we'll begin right away. Senator Berglund.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. We're going to kind of take things a little bit out of order here because we do have some witnesses that have been waiting an hour and need to leave. So we'll take some testimony on the bill, and then we'll go back to the amendments and the bill explanation.
Okay.
And I'd like to ask members if they could hold their questions till the end. I think that will help us to facilitate the bill in the time we have, perhaps.
Okay. If somebody has a clarifying question, we'll have them do that, but otherwise we'll hold questions. Okay.
I'd like to call on Holly Shemp.
Ms. Shemp, welcome to the committee, and please state your name and then go ahead with your testimony.
I might just say while she's signing in, Mr. Chairman, that I'll probably call on the witnesses out of order also just to make sure that everyone who is not a paid lobbyist or is not here as part of their job but has taken time off from work and is an ordinary citizen gets a chance to testify today in case we don't have time for everybody.
That sounds good. Maybe you can call the next two or so people you want so they can be ready to come
sure.
up right away.
Alva Neubauer, she could come up next.
Okay. Go ahead.
My name is Holly Shemp. I'm a student at MCTC, and I work at an after-school program at Ann Sullivan Communication Center in Ann Sullivan in South Minneapolis. I was in an accident, a bike accident, in October where I went over the handlebars and smashed my face on the concrete. And I went to Fairview Riverside for care. Don't have health insurance. I don't have health insurance because my school doesn't offer it, my work doesn't offer it, and I'm 24, and I can't be included on my mom's health insurance. Let's see. My experience for applying for Minnesota Care was, it took a long time. I applied immediately after my accident, and didn't hear anything until they asked for more information and returned that information, and they sent me a letter within the next week saying they hadn't received it, and if they don't receive it within 10 days, they're going to drop my application, which essentially happened, even though I sent in the stuff they requested. So right now, I'm just at the point of reapplying altogether and working with a community health worker at Fairview. All my bills are on hold because I'm in the process of applying. So,
thank you, Ms. Shemp. Mm-hmm. I hope your recovery continues well, and hope we can take care of the
shift.
Thank you for coming.
Yep.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of our committee. My name is Alva Neubauer, and I work as a housekeeper in United Hospital.
Ms. Neubauer, can you move the microphone a little bit closer? Thank you.
I also member the SEIU Local 113. I am here today to show our support for Senate File 2. This bill will allow families like mine to take Minnesota care. I am a single mom with four kids. As a housekeeper, I make about $30,000 per year. Until a couple years ago, my kids were covered under Minnesota care. But they were taken off the program because my employer, Alina Hospitals and Clinics, pay more than 50% of the premiums, which was very devastating for me. My second daughter has some kind of disability that was affecting the school. Her grades were bad. And so I make appointments with different specialists for her, and including the dentist, and I try to do the same day, not to miss work. So, and then I got a call from my dentist to say, we cannot take you because you don't have insurance. So I was very devastated. My world came down because we were so excited to find out what was wrong with my daughter. She's very smart. She's very intelligent. But it was something there that I didn't know. And she was very excited to that she would go to doctors to find out. Then I before I didn't put it in my insurance because it would take a lot of my check. And I was able to afford. So then I had to cancel all my appointments that day, which I was crying. And pretty soon I had all my children crying around me because we were very sad about. Then until 6 months later, I was able to get insurance in my work and able to take her to the doctors. But then I had to, I don't have no choice. My daughter was very important. And then I had to go charge my groceries and my credit cards. I had to charge pretty much everything they need because I couldn't afford. My payment in my house, which I consider cheaper to compare to another people in the community, is $900 a month. My check I bring home, it was $900 every 2 weeks. So the rest, to afford a home, it was very bad. Fortunately, after that, we got in negotiations in our company in Alina for the union, and we were able to have a little more affordable insurance, and Alina is committed to agree to get in the future a fully paid family care. But this is just not about me, you know. It's so many people. I was mentioned to somebody that after I was dropped and I was very devastated for the insurance, I found that so many people needs the insurance, and so many people was devastated, just like me, about not having the cover for their children. Sometimes adults, we don't care about us, you know, but our children, they get affected to be able to go to school, affected to do anything, and we cannot let them what are eating, and for has to be paying the insurance. I had co-workers who were part-times. They soon received a letter from the Minnesota Care said your employee pay 50%, you're not covered, no longer covered. They're paying 8% of their income for the insurance and the co-payments and the pay for the doctors. So I know this bill will help a lot of Minnesotans, and it will help a lot for the community. They're desperate. We need that. And I know that this change will be good for Minnesotans and for Minnesota Care. And I know that you guys want to change it, and it will be a good time. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Neubauer. Appreciate your coming.
Mr. Chairman, next I'd like to call on Leanne Erickson. She's a parent with her son, Ted Erickson. And after that, I'd like to ask Dr. Karen Baird to come up to the table.
Hi.
Hi.
As Senator Berglund said, I'm Leanne Erickson, and this is my son, Ted. Say hi.
Hi.
Ted is 43 years old. He has mental retardation, Tourette syndrome, sleep apnea, and a very severe seizure disorder. And in spite of his multiple disabilities, Ted lives semi-independently with his brother in his own home in Fairmont, Minnesota. We do live down south. It's very, very cold down there, too. So it doesn't help to be that far south. It is cold. Ted takes 6 different medications daily, plus he needs to have a 7th on hand to use during a seizure. Most of his medications are dealing with seizures, and because of that, he's not able to take generics. It's been a long process to get Ted's seizure disorder under control, but we now have a medication regime that has eliminated very many hospital stays. Ted works at a sheltered workshop in Fairmont. There are some side effects with Ted's medication, and that really does affect his work output. And that means his paycheck is affected. Ted works the same hours as his brother, who also has mental retardation and autism, but earns mainly only half as much money. Yes, it's disgusting, isn't it? Ted's paychecks many times are in the $50 range for 2 weeks of work. Ted is on Medicare as well as on medical assistance, and Medicare does not limit copays. So most of his medications are $3, So he can, if he has to refill all of his medications in 1 month, spend up to $21 that month. That means that he's probably spending about 20% of his take-home pay for that month on his medications. Some of his medications cause gum problems, so Ted needs some dental periodic deep cleaning. And when the limit was placed on dental services, it was a huge concern for us because they're not cheap, and he really does need them. It was a great relief when those were lifted in 205, and we do thank everybody who helped make sure that happened. So far, Ted has received the meds he needs, but I have heard from people that cannot get the correct meds from the doctors or cannot get the meds when they need them because they don't have the copay. And even though there is a law out there that says the pharmacy has to pay, the pharmacy has to give them meds, not all the pharmacies are doing that in some of the outstate areas. I think we are fortunate because we're in a smaller area, and the pharmacist knows us and works very hard to get the medications that Ted needs. Ted used to live in a waiver house with other housemates, and when he moved into his own home, it meant leaving behind some of the built-in financial security that Ted received as a resident of the waiver house. If he still lived there, he would get a reimbursement check of $12 a month, whether he took meds or not. He doesn't live there, so he does not get that type of check. We left other financial assistance security as well, and it's these people that are living as independently as possible. And when we did move Ted from the waiver house into semi-independent living, we knew that the financial security network would not be there for us, that his financial situation would deteriorate, that money would be tight. We felt that that would be outweighed by the increase in the quality of his lifestyle because there were concerns about the quality of life in the waiver house he was in. And that really has proven to be true. Ted's quality of life is wonderful at this point. However, this is what's happening. The people that are living semi-independently and at less cost to the taxpayers really cannot afford the copays that are happening and that they need to keep healthy. These are the people who are most severely affected by copays, and we need to eliminate copays for these people and make sure that they are able to live as independently as possible, as cheaply as possible, and as healthy as possible. We should not be having them pay large percentages of their income for medications. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson, and thank you, Ted, for coming up here today.
Then I'd like to call on Dr. Baird, and following Dr. Baird, I'd like to ask Christine Stone to the table.
Okay. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Baird.
Thank you, Senator Marty. My name is Mac Baird. I'm a family physician, professor, and head of the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at the University of Minnesota. I'm also chairman of the board of UCARE, and I'm on the board for Community University Health Center, or COOC as it's sometimes called. I'm here to comment only on some parts of Senator Berglund's bill, focused primarily on the copays and reduction or elimination of copays. I think we've heard eloquent statements earlier about the needs of people that are in this economic and social bracket that have special needs, and the copays and various mechanisms that in other populations are intended to, frankly, put cautionary marks around utilization simply don't work for that purpose in this population. So elimination of copays or reduction of out-of-pocket expenses as are planned in this bill is desirous for that reason. Secondly, what happens in effect, and we've heard again why this might happen, is that for the providers, especially in clinics, where this becomes a barrier for a visit, mostly that ends up as declared bad debt. And it frankly just undermines the financial viability of our safety net clinics, many of whom, if you were to review their assets, are in decline and vulnerable. And finally, for copays for pharmaceutical products, it's, as we heard earlier, tough enough to keep track of the various medications that might be needed for someone with chronic illnesses. But when those are compounded with what seem to be, for some of us, small copays, it can be just enough to have someone guess which medications on their own list are really essential and which ones aren't. And that can lead to significantly negative consequences. So for several reasons, co-pays are counterproductive in the public programs. And I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Dr. Baird. I appreciate that. And I think Ms. Erickson's comments on her son's difficulty paying those is a good illustration of that. Thank you. Ms. Stone, welcome to the committee.
And after that, I'd like Jason Stinson to come up to the table.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of the prescription drug provision included in Senator Berglund's legislation, Senate File 2. My name is Christine Stone, a volunteer with AARP Minnesota, representing 670,000 Minnesotans throughout the state. It sounds like a big figure. AARP Minnesota supports reducing the cost of prescription drugs for Minnesotans of all age. We believe it makes common sense to harness the purchasing power of consumers and the state to bring down drug prices. AARP supports the drug discount program included in Senate File 2. We also support the provision in the bill that would allow those with Medicare Part D coverage to purchase drugs at the Medicare rate that are not covered under Part D or drugs that are purchased when the individual is responsible for 100% of the cost. In addition, AARP supports the provision that allows a medical assistant recipient enrolled in Part D plan and a Medicare Advantage plan to have the copayment paid for by medical assistance. Despite efforts at the federal level to lower costs through the new Medicare drug benefit and efforts here in Minnesota to help consumers obtain lower cost prescription drugs, the fact remains that prescription drug prices for Minnesota consumers are still rising, and some consumers under the age of 65 are still without coverage. AARP research shows that prices for the most commonly used drugs continue to outpace inflation year after year. For consumers across the state, especially those without insurance coverage, the high cost of prescription drugs can be debilitating to household budgets. Too many Minnesotans are faced with the danger of losing their benefits and not being able to pay their bills. Millions of Americans can no longer afford the vital drugs that they need. Drugs have become so expensive that many people don't even fill their prescriptions. Others are forced to take drastic measures such as splitting pills or skipping doses. It makes common sense for the state to use its purchasing power to assist those who continue to pay out of pocket for their prescriptions. AARP strongly believes that this legislation will be a step toward truly making a difference in the pocketbooks of those who continue to struggle to pay for medication. I worked with Senator Berglund on the prescription bill drug for low-income seniors, and we had a good bill there, I think. But at the time I was working on that, I was getting so many people saying, but that's not fair. I mean, there's low and others. I mean, you have to consider the other generation. And I'm so happy that this bill does say to all Minnesotans that it isn't just for seniors. Also, I hear from seniors their problems as a rising cost, formularies getting changed on the Medicare Part D. And I hear from younger families, from those same people of their families within their families that don't have prescription drugs and they're really struggling. So I hope we can get this bill passed and get everybody covered. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Stone. Thank you very much for coming. Mr. Stinson?
Yeah. My name is Jason Stinson, and I'm the owner of Stinson Builders. It's a small residential contracting company. And Senator Berglund asked me, or I was asked to come in to talk about the effects of allowing Minnesota Care to be bought into by small business owners. Health insurance has been a huge issue for I've looked into getting health insurance for my company. I have five employees. two of which are not insured, one of which is on Minnesota Care, and the other two have insurance through their spouses. It's been a real challenge trying to get insurance for them that we can afford. Not only has it been difficult to navigate where to get accurate information, but once forming a small group has been very cost prohibitive for us. And I've talked about this with my peers, with my employees, and we've gone through, as we're a growing company, asking them, what's the most important benefit that I could provide, that our company could provide for you? Hands down, it's always health insurance. We had the one employee I have who is on Minnesota Care. I had an incident, or not an incident, but he is a very productive employee, has been learning a lot. And I gave him a raise about 6 months ago, and about 2 months ago, he kind of stopped showing, or he took a week off because he was sick, and then we had another couple weeks where he was asking for some additional personal time off. And when confronted on it, I asked him if he was unhappy about, you know, his work situation, what was exactly why he wasn't as reliable as he had been for the past year and a half. And we sat down and had a good talk, and the reason he wasn't coming to work is he was concerned about losing his eligibility to Minnesota Care due to the fact that his income had just increased. And he had been without insurance before that, and he didn't want to risk losing insurance. One of my other employees who is now covered through his spouse's insurance, they were in a really difficult situation when the spouse was suddenly unemployed, and they sought looking at individual insurance. She was turned down by Blue Cross Blue Shield. And that's when we really started looking into what we could do what I could offer as a company, and realistic costs of offering health insurance to my employees. And in doing that, first of all, it was difficult to get real answers from people I thought would be easy to get answers from. I contacted the city council, contacted Blue Cross Blue Shield, Medica. And once I finally started, I got prices ranging from per employee from $250 to $500, and it was really difficult to figure out what we could realistically afford. And when I talked to our employees about what they would be able to afford if we looked at purchasing this together, it was not feasible for us to provide health insurance. The last example I have is I have a new employee that I was fortunate enough to obtain who worked for a large commercial contracting company, and he's very knowledgeable. And he joined us due to the downturn in the economy, and he was working for a company that was able to provide him health insurance, among other benefits. And when they no longer had work and were laying him off frequently, I was able to talk him into joining us, and he's been working for us for 6 months and has really added a level of productivity to our company that is very appreciated and helpful. But he has also told me that if that company gets back on his feet and the market turns up, he will probably have to go back to that company due to the fact that they can give him health insurance and I can't provide it for him. So I think that's the end of my story.
Thank you, Mr. Stinson. I'm hearing from more and more employers, and plus I've heard from a lot of employees, especially in greater Minnesota, who are in the situation where you're one, where they have to not take a pay increase because of Minnesota Cares. Thank you for coming. Sarah Berglund, who you have
next? I'd like to call on Ava Kritzek and Lori Kiefer. And after that, it will be Laura Dingles.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Eva Kritzek, and I'm here to support the Senate file number 2. I work for the St. Cloud Area Legal Services as an intake person. We cover 7 counties for low-income people. In the past, for several years, we were grantees for the Minnesota CARE. I was an advocate, assisting people not only filling out the application, but to compile information and documentation that needs to be provided to the Minnesota CARE. This was probably one of the most frustrating part for a lot of people first of all, the overwhelming and frustration for clients was to that they found the application really cumbersome, large, lengthy, and frustrated to be able to understand it and fill it out in a time when there was a real a lot of stress on the client and illness to be even able to think about how to start that application. So it was amazing the number of cases that we were assisting people in filling these applications out. I myself, as an advocate, needed, training in how to fill those applications. I don't think that people should wait that long or to fill out these applications to receive medical coverage because of the complexity. We have many, many, examples of people that went through this with these problems. One of them was to, of course, get the information that they needed from employers a lot of time that they needed in order to meet those deadlines for the Minnesota CARE. We could not get that information a lot of times on time or the person themselves on their own. For example, some of the employers requested if a person didn't know or happened not to have kept the income verification, they needed to provide new paycheck stubs, which the employer was charging to reproduce another copy of that income verification. Needless to say, this parent with low income was not able to pay or didn't have the money, plus the time that it was going to take to provide that information. Again, I have many examples in several groups that fall into different categories, and this particular, I'm going to give you a couple of examples. Mom, for example, with 4 children, a single mom trying to get medical coverage for her family and her children, and of course not being able to provide that information right away, and an illness can't wait. They have to have the medication right on as soon as possible. Another category is our students that are kind of on limbo. Students that are kind of on their own, they're 18, and they are without insurance because the parents are low income and they are studying on their own. One of their concerns is to miss classes, not being able to attend school, plus not getting their medications. Not getting the medication on time is going to bring the student not to attend school and struggle with all areas. Thank you. I guess that's what I have to
say. Thank you, Ms. Kritzek. I appreciate your testimony.
This is Lori Kiefer.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Lori Kiefer, and I'd like to thank you for letting me come here and speak today on Senate File 2. I'm here to represent the people here in Minnesota who have to live like I do. They are the disabled, the handicapped, people who cannot work, the poor, our senior citizens, and of course our veterans. I am considered way below the poverty line because I'm disabled and cannot work. I even have doctor's orders who say I will never be able to work because if somebody has a cold and I catch it, it turns into pneumonia and I'm in bed for 3 months, 2 to 3 months. That's how weak my immune system is. If I had a nickel left in my pocket by the end of the month after paying all the co-pays that I have to pay for doctor bills and my medications and everything, I'd be doing really good. Most months, it doesn't get that lucky. I don't get that lucky because what happens is Medicare Part D and Minnesota care has taken my life away. You mention health care to people, they cringe, and then they get very angry, and their blood pressure just rises. I tell you why people get very angry. It's because the state of Minnesota has the worst health care system in the country, in the United States. We are at the bottom of the list when it comes to health care. Out of 50 states, we are at number 50. I'd like to see Minnesota be within the top 5 ratings for best health care in the United States. I do not know why we have to spend so much money in like Iraq and Iran and other foreign countries to feed, clothe, give them health care, and give them medicine, and to rebuild their countries. I did some research, and according to the GOA report, it breaks down like this. It's a very short report, so I'm trying not to give you too many numbers here. 2003 to 2004, they got $20.9 billion. September of 2006, they received another $257.5 billion. They spent all that. In October of 2006, they were given another $29 billion to spend. And as recently as January of 2007, they were given another $495 billion to spend. If we could spend that much money in a foreign country, why can't we take care of our own people? And you wonder why people are poor, angry, and depressed like me. I personally have a lot of medical problems, and a lot of them are serious medical problems, like my low blood sugars, my depression, my PTSD, my severe sleep apnea, severe allergies, and the list can go on forever. On Medicare Part D last year, I spent $3,200 for their spend down. Now in 2007, they increased it to $3,800. In Minnesota Care last year, I spent $300 on medications for copays. And I expect that to go up too this year. That money was only spent on the bare necessities of the medications I need to cover all my health care problems. And in the state of Minnesota, they used to be able to cover everything for me. And now it comes out of my pocket, and I don't have anything left at the end of the month because it's all spent on medicine or doctor visits. And if I do go get a medication from Medicare Part D, they always tell me, they always say, it's not on our formulary, so we can't give it to you. And the state of Minnesota will say, we don't cover it anymore. So if you really want that medication, you'll have to pay for it out of your own pocket. Well, I don't have that kind of money. Just take it out of my own pocket. And I did some research that it costs the pharmacies, I mean, it costs the companies to make one lousy pill a few cents. They charge the pharmacies $2 to $3. And then the consumer like me, for the copay to cover it, would cost $3 to $5 for one lousy pill. That's not fair. It's not fair for anyone. And when I go see a medical doctor, I usually have a half-hour scheduled medical appointment. Well, I end up seeing my doctor for approximately 2 to 3 minutes. And that's because Minnesota and Medicare require a stack of paperwork, and therefore, after that, you get seen for two to three minutes from your doctor. Then they have to go rush off and do their paperwork so everybody can make sure they have it done. Otherwise, they get trouble. And I think that's really unfair. And then if they send me to a specialist or send anyone to a specialist, especially me, I'm talking about myself here, then It's the same routine, 2-3 minutes, and then paperwork. And then you get back to the, you go back to the, it's not fair. We just, it's just the same thing after, one thing after another. I can't afford all those all that money in co-pays. I have to wait till I'm really sick to go to the doctor. And I really think that's unfair. And I need to be watched closely with all my serious medical problems. And I just want to say one more thing, that my mental health doctors ordered me a light box for my depression. And Medicare and Minnesota Care denied it. They wanted more information. They wanted to know if it worked before. I don't know if it worked before because I never had one before. The doctor said that too. And so it doesn't make any sense. I mean, I could go on and on here, but to save time, I just want to say that that I wrote a proposal that would make Minnesota a lot easier state. I'd like to say that under my proposal, we all the whole state of Minnesota will be covered, and yet we will all be treated fair and equally. Because we are human beings, I am a human being, and I should not feel like I have to be caged up in some cage somewhere, like I'm a wild animal. My constitutional rights are being violated, and I do not like that at all.
Thank you, Ms. Kiefer.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a question?
Sarah Hand.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask a question of the witness?
We don't want to get into a long discussion with them if it's clarifying about something they're saying. But
thank you, Mr. I'll just very briefly, Ms. Kiefer, you mentioned in your testimony that Minnesota has the worst health care of any state in the country. I'm not aware of that. Could you give us the reference for that data? I think that is in dispute, and if you have information that you can present us with, I'd like to know what it is.
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Kiefer,
briefly. I didn't get your name, but Senator, it's like this. I've done a lot of calling around and got numbers, and they're saying that the state of Minnesota is the worst state when it comes to health care because we cannot get anything organized. We are very unorganized when it comes to health care.
Senator Hahn, I think this is Ms. Kiefer's opinion. I will say that there are quite a number of other states that do pay the co-payment for their dual eligibles in the Part D program, and from her perspective, I think she would believe that those states provide better health care than we do.
And
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, and Senator Berglund, I appreciate that, and I understand that witnesses come and some give their experiences or their opinions, but when they come and state things of factual content that can be verified, I think we ought to make sure they're correct because those things should play into our decision-making. And so I just thought that if that was a fact, that we ought to establish that. And I know there's been some discussion about what our health care system is like in the country and in Minnesota. And I think those things could be verifiable. And if we're going to have testimony, I think it should be factual.
Excuse me, Ms. Kiefer. I think we're not going to get into this any further. I think this is a difference of opinion. And Sir Han, I believe that's her opinion about it. But let's not get into that now.
I just want to say that, Mr. Chair, that I do have evidence of other states.
Okay. We don't want to get into that now. You can share it with Senator Hahn if you would like to. And Ms.
That'd be great.
Senator
Mr.
Berglund,
Chairman,
please.
After Ms. Dingell's testimony, I'd like to have Bob Lefebvre come to the table.
Go ahead, Ms. Dingell. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair and members of the committee, hi. My name is Laura Dingell. I live at Andrew Residence, a program serving adults like myself who have a mental illness. I have paranoid schizophrenia. I am one of about 145 people at Andrew who have a mental illness who find ourselves with medication bills we cannot pay. We are being asked to pay the co-payments for the cost of our medications with money we do not have. My income consists of Social Security disability insurance. By state rules, any income I have goes to the cost of my care, and I am limited to a personal needs allowance of $114 a month. That $114 a month is all I have. It's to buy new shoes, a coat, winter clothing, go to a movie, gifts, buy pop, or anything else I may need. Prior to Medicare Part D, the medications I needed to keep me stable and out of the hospital were completely paid for by the state. Today I am being charged, one, a $265 a year Part D deductible, two, co-payments of 25% for every prescription filled, three, Medicare Part D insurance premiums of $1,060 each month. I receive $114 personal needs allowance, and I'm being billed for $355 in deductible premium and co-payments for January. Please tell me how to turn the $114 into $355. Many people who with mental illness do not want to take their meds. I do. It is unwise to prevent persons with mental illness from getting access to medications. Please consider what you are asking of people like me and others with mental illness. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dingles, for your testimony. Mr. Lefebvre.
Mr. Chair, my name is Bob Lefebvre. I'm the executive director with the Minnesota Milk Producers Association. I have the fortunate opportunity of working for Minnesota's hardworking dairy farmers. I'm here today to specifically and asking your support for Section 22 of the bill here today, which eliminates the add-back of depreciation for farm self-employed income for purposes of determining income eligibility under Minnesota CARE. Basically, this would allow more of our small family dairy farmers to qualify and become eligible for Minnesota CARE. Healthcare accessibility and affordability has been an issue with dairy producers for a number of years, and it was really this year that the issue has surged, if you will, in importance for dairy producers. I'll give you a couple of examples. As a grassroots organization, we're constantly receiving, asking for input from our members. We do this in a number of ways. One of the ways is we have picnics on the farm, and we do surveys and so on and so forth. And this year, through those avenues and others, we saw that this issue certainly spiked. So it's becoming extremely important. And I'll just give you one example of a dairy producer. Happens to be one of my directors as well, from Stearns County, milks 50 cows. Him and his wife are paying over $1,600 a month just for health insurance, and they're, you know, in fairly decent condition. And so, again, we believe that this portion would certainly help our family dairy farmers in Minnesota have better access to affordable health insurance.
Thank you. And you said it was $1,600 a month that farmer and his spouse are paying?
Yes.
Thank you. Sarah Berger?
Next, I'd like to call on Sarah Stace.
Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Stace, I don't see her in the room.
Okay. Well, let's move on then. Mr. Chairman, we have a number of other witnesses, but most of them have provided letters so that if we don't have time for all of them to testify today, the letters are available in your packet. The next thing I'd like to do, Mr. Chairman, is to move the author's amendments to the bill.
Okay.
And I'd like to move
Mr. Chair.
As one motion.
Okay.
And,
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, are we going to hear the opposition testimony?
Yes, we will be hearing that. I don't care if you want to do that before this.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to make sure that some
that they're
of
testifying
the witnesses
on,
that
if they have concerns about your address.
Took time off from work would get a chance to testify. before they had to leave. And so that's why we were taking things a little bit out of order, and we did mention that before everyone arrived at the committee meeting.
We'll get the bill in shape, and then we'll finish with the testimony.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the A3 amendment. These are minor technical changes. The A4 amendment that deals with the federally qualified clinics and removing the Medicare cap on the payments that those clinics are allowed to receive under an alternative payment system that existed prior to 2001. The A6 amendment, which tightens up the small employer buy-in
option. Excuse me, Senator Berglund. Members of the committee have all these amendments, I believe, in a little packet, paper clip together.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, given that there are so many, could we maybe, I understand you said the A3 and it was technical, maybe you could go just a little slower as we shuffle these papers so that we could see what we're talking about. I understand there are author's amendments, Mr. Chair, but there's quite a few of them.
The A6 amendment will tighten up the small employer buy-in option and address technical issues as a part of that provision. A7 exempts workers' compensation settlements from the asset limit for Minnesota Care. A9 will put back in the copayments for non-emergency visits to emergency rooms for medical assistance and GAMC. The A10 amendment.
Senator Berglund, Senate Counsel said that you had a change you wanted to incorporate in the A9 amendment.
Yes, I do. So maybe she could read that at this time.
Mr. Chair and members, it's on line 11, delete home and insert facility.
So Senator Berglund, you're going to incorporate that into the A9 amendment?
Yes.
Where is that?
Page 1 of the A9 amendment, line 11, delete home and insert facility. So it would read in hospital nursing facility. Okay, the A10 amendment?
The A10 amendment changes and scopes out further the outreach program for our Minnesota healthcare programs. The A11 amendment specifies that the Legislative Oversight Commission on Healthcare may convene subcommittees and that state agencies would provide assistance and technical help to that group to reach their recommendations to the legislature for universal health care coverage by 2010. The A12 amendment creates an electronic health record revolving account loan, no interest loan program. The A13 amendment, the A13 amendment increases the income eligibility for single adults and households without children.
Excuse me, Senator Berglund, you explained A12, and that's been taken out of the packets because it's been redrafted as A18. So
A18.
Members, if you did not have A12, that's why.
So that's an
A11 and then A13 you're offering as part. Okay.
So that's an A18 amendment. The A13 amendment increases income eligibility for single adults and households without children to 215% of the federal poverty guideline effective July 1st of 2009, and that's to make sure that folks who will may be receiving the new federal minimum wage increase will still qualify for the program at that time. The A14 amendment, creating an emergency room diversion demonstration project for Hennepin and Ramsey County. Then I have an A15 amendment that deletes the sections in the bill related to a constitutional amendment. I believe that bill will be traveling as a separate bill. The A17 amendment, which addresses a situation that's been called to our attention where someone was denied Minnesota care even though they had been a lifelong resident of the state because they were living in a shelter They were working and were not eligible for other public programs, but they were denied because they could not provide a verified address at a residence. Their address is at a place of public accommodation, and so that would take care of that situation. And then there's an A-19 amendment, which adds...
A-19 has not been passed. It's being distributed as you explain it.
Okay. The A-19 amendment is an amendment that has been requested by the Hospital Association, which will provide information reporting and disclosure program based on the Q-Care standards that they are trying to abide by. And so it's updating the statute in regard to those items. Those are the author's amendments, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, I'm really surprised at the number of author's amendments, because generally, as I've always had the impression that one or two was acceptable, that we accepted a few things that were trying to get the bill in the form that the author had wanted it in, and generally kind of accepted those if there was small changes. But I'm just, you know, it seems like you're adding entire bills into this bill right now, and maybe it should have been put together as a delete all, as opposed to, you know, I lost count. 20? Is that how many we have?
Senator Fischbach, there are not quite that many, but again, the other approach which authors often do is to delete everything. I think one reason sometimes this can be more helpful is when there are many provisions and people have been tracking a bill for a period of time. I think that's one of the reasons that I'm guessing she wanted to put the bill in this shape before testimony, because some of the people may have concerns about very specific sections. And if you just give somebody a delete everything, those who've been tracking the bill don't know what's changed. In this way, they can have in front of them each of the...
But, Mr. Chair, no one was... Or was everyone else aware that these were all going on to this bill prior to just now?
I was not aware
of all
the
changes. So, Mr. Chair, the public wasn't necessarily informed,
right.
So they don't know what's coming in.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, we have shared some of these amendments with members of the public. In fact, we have been asking for many, many people that have come to my office this year so far for input on the outreach section of the bill, and that many of those suggestions have been incorporated into the amendment that I offered in regard to that section. Other amendments are being offered at the request and suggestion of other people that have looked at various sections of the bill.
I guess, Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if this is really, you know, do all of these qualify? I guess the definition of an author's amendment is kind of vague, but some of these, I think, deserve more explanation.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to answer questions when we get done presenting the bill. In the meantime, these are the author's amendments. The tradition of the Senate is to let an author offer the amendments that they want to put the bill in the shape they would like to have it before you begin discussion on it.
So, Mr. Chair, we're going to be allowed as the author to... If we are establishing a new kind of policy that the author's amendments can be as many as they'd like, whatever they'd like, then and accepted by the committee for whatever reason. I'm trying to be clear so I understand.
I don't know if this is as new as you're making it sound. I've usually seen people offer one long page and line amendment instead of 10, 12, 15 of them. But I actually prefer the page and line this way instead of delete everything, because at least that way you can see what's being changed instead of, I've seen authors come in and drop in a totally new 50-page delete everything amendment, and you're kind of relying on them to tell you what's there. I think that I would have expected more likely that there'd be one big amendment and then maybe a couple little ones, but I don't think this is a change in that way. And again, the author's amendments, that's tradition. There's no requirement. You can you can choose to vote against author's amendments. It's just generally the thought is we get the author the chance to listen to people after they introduce their bill and make changes, and we still have the chance to debate everything. It's usually better if I personally think if we have the bill in a shape, at least the author likes it in, and then we go and you can delete any sections, you can amend them, you can go back to what was there originally if you prefer it that way.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I will say that in the years that I've been here, the definition of an author's amendment has become very, very loose, very broad, you know, originally, or at least the way I remember it was intended to be a little more, here's some technical things, and a lot more explanation. I mean, I have to admit, we used to get a lot more explanation of what was going into bills, the bill itself, and you know, what was really going on. And I am wondering, Mr. Chair, are we going to have time to discuss the bill? I realize I'm taking some time, but I do want to understand what's happening.
It's very appropriate you ask, and I think we do have to have the time. The question is, do we spend the time in debating these amendments, some of which are not controversial and so on?
Not debating, but understanding, Mr. Chair.
I understand, but the point is, if she's going to do her explanation of the bill once it's in shape, that, to me, that would be the appropriate time to debate it. But again, it's only a tradition. People can oppose putting it in the shape the author wants it, and I'm sure that has happened as well, but Senator Berglund has asked that we put it this way, and then she goes through the bill and explains it, and then we have the debate based on that. If you prefer it the other way, I guess the way to do that would be to oppose the author's amendments.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, I just want to make it clear that the minority is allowed to offer amendments in committee still?
You are going to have time. I don't think we're going to get, just looking at the time, I do not think we're going to finish this bill today, as I would have liked, but that's beyond our control.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Senator Corrigan.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is appropriate for me to speak at this time as the lead Republican on this committee. I have talked to some of our members in the minority, and we're concerned about the last couple of committee meetings that there is a lot of testifiers, and that's great. We're glad to have, we need to hear these stories. But we're just concerned that we get down and we have 5 or 10 minutes to have discussion, and we've had this discussion on the Senate floor. I think it's important that if we don't feel like all the members' questions have been answered, that the bill should be taken up the next time, rather than having members feel we all paid our $100, and I think we all we've heard that before, and so I just think it's important that we all. I know we're in the minority, but we still have, I still make just as much as you do, and you don't make any more than I do, and it's important that we have the chance to ask the questions, and that's all I'm asking.
And Senator Corrigan, you will have that, and I'm not one who likes to cut off debate. Yeah. I will assure you of that.
Mr. Chairman, I thank you for that.
And I realize that I'd rather we have the debate in the committee after we've had the testimony rather than don't want to debate the witnesses on it. Let's debate among ourselves and dealing with the amendments.
That's exactly
going
right.
Through it. And yes, I expect that some of the minority members and some of the majority members will have amendments for this as well. Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question for Senator Berglund about the A14 portion of it, because I think it's an important question before we do vote. Senator Berglund, I've had some experience with emergency room diversion, and I've been told by physicians that they can't do under federal law what you're asking to be done in the A14.
Senator Berger.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Wergen, in fact, this pilot program is a replica of one that's being done in Wisconsin. And the way that it works is clinics sign up with the program, and then hospitals sign up with the program, and then there are people that are stationed in the emergency room who visit with people while they're waiting for their appointment and offer them oftentimes a same-day appointment that's available in one of the clinics. And then the clinics that are involved in it agree that if the person is uninsured but eligible for an existing program in the state, that they will help them to get enrolled in that program. And so the idea is to work with people on a voluntary basis. Nobody can be denied care in an emergency room if they come there. But, you know, if you have a choice of sitting there and waiting 6 hours or having an appointment within an hour at a clinic that could serve you as well, if not better, most of the time people would prefer to take the physician clinic appointment. And this program also does deal with dental emergency room visits, which, as you know, don't really solve the problem. They just provide pain medications. And so it does include dental. And so if there are vacancies, somebody cancels that morning, there's a vacancy, then they can get that person that has that dental pain into a dental office.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Senator Berglund, you're essentially talking more about a triage mm-hmm. with a voluntary choice at the end of the triage piece rather than a typical medical diversion, because a medical diversion means you go. But if you're triaged and have a voluntary choice, that's different.
This is a special program that works with the clients in the emergency room to encourage more appropriate utilization of primary care and dental clinics as opposed to more inappropriate emergency room. And I think this program has saved a lot of money in Wisconsin, and so I think it can do several things here for us. It can reduce the uncompensated emergency room costs. It can help people get a medical home. It can help be an outreach program to get people signed up and enrolled in our Minnesota care healthcare programs.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With all of these amendments, doesn't each amendment have an additional fiscal note?
Senator Johnson, some of these are deleting sections of the bill. Some may have fiscal notes, some may not. That's not the primary function of this committee.
Oh,
but,
I see.
I mean, the budget issues will have to be resolved, and I think most of these would be in Senator Berglund's division, but I don't know. The question is, I'm sure some may have fiscal notes. Are there other questions on Senator Berglund's motion? Is an author's amendment that would incorporate the language of A3 through 4, A6 and 7, A9, which had a one-word change in it, A10, 11, 13 through 15, 17 through 19. Is there any discussion of that? Again, we will have to have the explanation of the bill after this is incorporated in. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Senator Berglund, do you want to explain the bill now?
And yes, Mr. Chairman.
And then we'll take the witnesses. I know there are at least four people who had asked to speak with concerns to all or parts of the bill, but you'll deal with them after the explanation.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this bill is a combination of a number of different proposals. They fall into three categories, and I believe they move us down the road toward the goal of achieving universal coverage in the state of Minnesota. The bill does ask for the next step of the process to be handled by the Healthcare Access Commission and bring recommendations back to the legislature next year. The three categories fall into three kind of broad descriptions. The first one is outreach and improving the ability for those who are already eligible for our programs to enroll in them. We know that 80% of our children are already eligible for an existing program. 80% of our uninsured children are already eligible for an existing program. So part of the task has to be simplifying the forms, making it easier to enroll, making it less frequent to enroll, and reducing the premiums to make it more affordable to enroll, and this bill incorporates all of those kind of features. The second area is expanding eligibility to include more of the uninsured, and this bill does that in a number of areas as well. And the last is reducing the cost of health care and cost containment, and this bill has features in it that reduce administrative costs, improve the quality of of care and thereby reducing costs and reducing uncompensated hospital care costs and passing those savings on to consumers, purchasers, and taxpayers. I have some charts that are in your packet that I want to just refer to briefly because I think it's important that we understand that we have, you know, some limited resources here to invest in trying to address the needs of the uninsured in Minnesota. And I think it's important that those resources be strategically invested to meet the goal as much as possible. And so I think it's important to understand exactly where the problems of the uninsured lie. So the first chart is a chart that shows the potential sources of insurance coverage for uninsured children in Minnesota. And it shows that we have about 8.3% of our children who are uninsured, who are not eligible for a public program and not eligible for employer coverage. The next chart shows the uninsured rates in the state of Minnesota between 1995 and 2004. And I might mention, Mr. Chairman, that these charts were taken from the Department of Health report on the uninsured. And it shows that the uninsured have grown. Between 2001 and 2004, we've seen the number of uninsured in our state increase by almost 2%. If you look at the next chart, it's titled Uninsurance Rates by Age in the State of Minnesota. And what this chart shows us is that the largest group of people who are uninsured today are between 18 and 24 years old, with the next largest group being 25 to 34-year-olds. And so it's important to understand that. We have a couple of proposals in this bill that will especially affect those age group of individuals. If you then look at the sources of coverage for the non-elderly adults without children, you will see that the largest group also that's uninsured or without sources of coverage are adults without children, and that has grown rather dramatically between 2001 and 2004. And then if you look at the chart that talks about sources of coverage for non-elderly by age, again you see that the 18 to 24-year-olds followed by the 25 to 34-year-olds are the largest group that have no affordable source of coverage. And so this proposal really tries to hone in and target these. It does expand coverage for children, but it also tries to address some of the other problems that we have with uninsured people in our state.
Okay, thanks.
The first part of this bill, Mr. Chairman, deals with caps on health care expenditures and health care premiums. And I'd like to call your attention to this chart that's titled Private Health Insurance Premium and Spending Trends from 1995 to 2005. And the reason I wanted to call your attention to this chart is because between 1995 and 1997, we had similar caps on premiums and expenditures in the state of Minnesota. And where we had been experiencing triple-digit inflation in healthcare premiums previous to that time, we were able to bring down not only the premiums but the expenses to make sure that healthcare coverage would stay more affordable for the people in Minnesota. And this proposal is similar to that, except that it does have a little bit more latitude in regard to the caps. We start with the Consumer Price Index. We add 2% because we have a growing elderly population and we have a growing demand for technology. And then one additional percentage point is added to finance implementation of electronic medical record systems in the state. There is an exemption if there's a major disaster or bioterrorism or a major public health emergency. And so there are quite a number of sections that talk about these health care spending caps. The purpose of this really is to make sure that the savings that we're trying to generate in this bill will be passed on to consumers, and that we will then not see this continuing spiraling increase in health care costs, which drives more and more people into the state of uninsurance and needing to rely on public programs.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Fischbach.
What sections are those?
One.
Ms. Senator Berglund?
Three.
So is there a way for us to kind of follow along?
Section 1, Section 3, Section 4, Section 5, Section 6, Section 7, and I think there's a couple more sprinkled a little bit later on.
Senator Fischbach, it looks like page 4, Section 3 spells out the details of how the...
Okay. Well, now, Mr. Are you using the bill itself?
I was just
okay,
yeah,
because
looking at the bill, page
it's
4.
It's not engrossed with all these.
Well, there were no amendments to this section of the bill.
Okay. So when we get to those, you will point out where they are?
There is an amendment that the Department of Employee Relations is requesting, but we didn't have time to get that ready for today, so we'll do that in the next committee where they will be focusing on this particular section of the bill.
Okay, so, Mr. Chair, you're on page, because I was trying to look at this, but I don't think
that doesn't have the
relates.
Detail. Page
yeah,
4
exactly.
of the bill has the details of the
okay.
CPI for urban consumers plus 2% plus the 1% and so on.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure we're all on the same page,
good.
So to speak.
I appreciate the question.
Thank you.
Continue.
The next major section of the bill deals with expanding the definition of dependent coverage in our private insurance market, and I'd like to just indicate that that is in Section 2 and Section 8 of the bill. And while I turn it over to Senator Lynch to make a few remarks about this section, since she is also the author of this as an independent bill, I'd like to call your attention to this chart, which is in your handouts, which describes to you the states that either have passed similar laws to this one or are considering laws like this one.
Senator Lynch.
And this expands the definition of dependent care to age 25.
Senator Lynch, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. My comments will specifically address Section 2, as Senator Berglund outlined, and it specifically deals with the definition of dependent. And very simply, would enable those individuals who are, in fact, dependents under the age of 25 to be considered dependents under this definition. And there would be no bearing. The major difference is that there's no bearing on whether or not that individual is enrolled in an academic institution or not. I think that this is a very good way to increase accessibility for a given population that quite often falls through the cracks or is left sort of hanging without a lot of options.
Yeah, that's the highest uninsured category. How did 25 come in? Was that just a figure?
Mr. Chairman, if you look at the chart, there's a few different ages that states have used. I've got an age column on the chart.
You have one with the states?
The states that have done this or are considering doing this, and the ages that they're using. Most of the states are using age 25, which is what is in this bill. There's a few that have age 24. There's a couple that have age 26. And there's one that has age 30, but that's between 25 and 30, you have to be in college. So we picked 25. That's what most of the states have used.
Thank you. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Lynch or Senator Berglund, just I had some questions about that as I was reading through the bill. And, in fact, the chart that you provided us with, there's only three states that have a similar provision. Most other states that have coverage to age 25 usually have some kind of qualification that they have to be enrolled in school or some other kind of qualification. And I'm just wondering, so this would mean the change you're proposing, that if a person were 25, had a job, living away from home, may even have insurance in that job, but may not be as good as the insurance that they would be. I don't know, but just that there'd be, that the definition of dependent is just age 25?
Unmarried.
Unmarried.
And age 25 or less. So. And Senator Marty and Senator Hahn, I think that this distinction of whether you're in college or not is pretty arbitrary, actually. Well, you don't have to be living at home. Most college students are working as well. They maybe have employers that are offering or not offering insurance, but today the criteria is your child has to be enrolled in college. And this would expand it to say that a child could be considered a dependent on their parents' coverage up to age 25, regardless of whether they're in college, as long as they're unmarried.
And Mr. Chairman, I guess the reason I'm asking, I know that there is for tax purposes and a definition of what a dependent is, and I take it that this is a different understanding of the
yes.
word dependent, and I guess I'm unclear about that. I mean, I can understand a person who is depending on a family for income and all those kinds of things, but to be completely independent except for one thing, which is to rely on the family for health insurance or eligibility for health insurance, seems a little peculiar. And I'm wondering if that isn't too broad a definition. I understand the desire to try to include people who are already eligible and may not be there for some purpose, but I think this seems to be an overly broad approach to do that, and does it not contribute to perhaps some higher cost to the system as a whole?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, you may not agree with this provision. I think it's a good provision. It strengthens our private insurance system. It allows parents who are very concerned about making sure that their children that are just left the nest have health care coverage, because even though they, quote unquote, have left the nest, if something happens that they get sick and have, you know, a big medical encounter, chances are, oftentimes, the parents are called in to help deal with the cost of that. And so I think many, many students who are in college are not living at home, are not being supported by their parents. So, you know, the idea that you're in college or you're not in college, you get health insurance or you don't get health insurance. What happens if your child is in college and they get sick and they can't re-enroll the next quarter? Then they're going to lose their health care coverage just at the time they most needed it. So I think this is a good provision in the bill. It does target one of the categories that we have that are the largest uninsured, and it does it in a way that allows parents who wish to make that contribution to help their children have that health care coverage do it through the private sector.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I think that this is simply it's another vehicle aimed at trying to increase accessibility and, in turn, to seek to control some of those costs. And I believe that there are individuals within the very age category that we are talking about that end up in our system or end up in our emergency rooms. And this is a potential vehicle that we can offer that seeks to address that loophole.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to kind of clarify this, in the charts you've provided, you show that that is the highest sector of category, age category, that has uninsurance. But how does that compare to what is the largest sector that has where the costs are occurring? In other words, what I have understood, and I could very well be wrong, but that age category may not have very high health needs. I'm trying to remember if when I was 25, if I had health insurance at all. I don't think I did. And I think there are a lot of people who are younger that, for whatever reason, they don't have life insurance, they don't have all kinds of things because they feel they don't need to. And it may be that statistically that as a category, their health costs are not high. And then to say, well, we're going to include them and put them and pay for through public means a health insurance policy when it may not be needed seems to me to be, again, drawing the net a little too broad. I mean, if there is a particular need, let's try to focus on that. How do we do that? But I'm just concerned that we're adding a cost for insurance to a group of people that may not, who knows why they're not insured. They may not be insured by choice. They may, I don't know. I'm just asking, where do the costs go? Do the costs, are the costs in that category for health care, or is it just a category that has high rates of uninsurance?
I see several other members here who want to, I'm guessing, comment on this issue. We can do that. Go ahead. We'll start with Senator Erickson Ropes and move this way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Berglund, Senator Lynch, isn't this just giving parents the option if they want to cover
right.
their children under
exactly.
their family plan to do it if they want to? And if the kids have flown the nest and landed and they're working and they can afford their own insurance or they decide not to get insured, they can. But this way, it just gives parents the option
right.
to cover their kids if they want to under a family plan to 25.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Senator Wergen.
Mr. Chair, that answered it somewhat, but I'm still not real sure. You have a 22-year-old that's working full-time, not a student. They would be eligible for employance. They would be eligible for insurance at their employer. Choose not to take it. They would still be eligible under the parents' plan and under the public plan.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Wergen, at this point, we're just talking about private insurance. We're not talking about making anybody eligible for a public plan. We're just talking about a parent who wants to have that option to cover their child. And, you know, it would be very burdensome to have insurance companies have to determine whether people have any other source of insurance. Insurance companies don't do that today for anybody. If you want to buy insurance, they don't ask you, well, do you have dependent coverage offered through your spouse? They just sell you a policy. Well, this would be allowing these unmarried children to stay on their parents' policies as a dependent if the parent would choose to cover them. And many times these young people starting out don't have that good of a job. And so they may not be able to afford their employer's coverage even if the employer does offer it. And it may be much better for them to stay on their parents' policy as a dependent, and that would be a decision that they and their family would make.
Senator Torres-Ray, did you have a comment yet?
I think Senator Berglund just addressed this. I think this is a very important population, and it's a very vulnerable population. This population is economically stable because they do have a job, and so they are trying to move into independency, but they cannot afford to pay for health care. And most of the jobs, as I hear and from people at the university who are graduating, and cannot find stable jobs that offer health care, and that's a significant problem. But as they move on in their careers, they do find more stable jobs and that offer health care, and I think this 2 or 3 years is significant, are very significant in their lives. And I think we really should consider this very seriously. It's very important for their stability in moving into a more stable life. And we need to think about this. And like you said, Senator Han, I do think this is a very healthy group. So I don't think it will be a large expense.
And Senator Han, and then I'd like to move on if we can. And we won't get through the bill, obviously, today, the explanation, but we can maybe do 5 more minutes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Berglund, you mentioned that this was for the private insurers to do this. And do they support this provision? Are the private insurers in favor of expanding this eligibility to dependents up to age 25 without qualification? Do they have any concern about that?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Han, I haven't heard from all the insurers in the state, but I have heard from Blue Cross Blue Shield, who said they really like this provision in the bill.
Mr. Senator Chair, Lynch. If I could just add that this is as a standalone is Senate File 78, and I have not heard any opinions to that effect.
Okay. Senator Berglund, can you go through any more in the
yeah.
next 5 minutes, and then we'll
mm-hmm.
call it off because we've got to keep moving on. We'll finish the bill on, I hope, Monday.
The next section would be Section 8, and it would require that Hospitals and healthcare providers have in place interoperable electronic health records by January 1st of 2015, and that the Health Information Technology and Infrastructure Advisory Committee would develop a statewide plan to meet the goal, including uniform standards for an interoperable system. The amendment that was added creates a loan fund for providers, an interest-free loan fund, revolving loan fund for providers who need assistance in helping to get an electronic medical record started. And I think the governor's proposal provides grants. We're a little concerned that the round of grants won't be enough for everybody, and then we'll be in next session asking for another round of money for grants. So this creates kind of a revolving fund where, as it gets paid back, more providers can.
Members, that's the A18 amendment, the loan fund.
Right. More providers can benefit then from the money that we would make available for this purpose. The next section is sections 11 to 13, and this is the section that would reiterate our commitment as a state to achieve universal health care coverage for all Minnesotans by the year 2010, and would require the Legislative Commission on Health Care Access to provide recommendations how to achieve this goal. And in the amendment, we added the ability for them to create subcommittees and to involve the state agencies in technical assistance aspects of their work.
This will allow the 11 amendment is the one that you're talking about.
Right. So this would allow the Healthcare Access Commission to bring in experts from the private sector to involve legislators who might not be appointed to the Healthcare Access Commission to work on working groups. And,
Fishbach, did you have a question?
Have input into the plan.
Okay, Mr. Chair, you said the A11.
That's the legislative oversight.
Okay.
Subdivision.
I'm just looking for it. But maybe in the meantime, I was just going to ask a question here, Mr. Chair. Did the A11 delete Section 12 or in any way change Section 12? It's on page 13, lines 13, 10 through.
It does not. No.
Okay, because Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering if we generally put goals in statute.
Mr. Chairman, this is not direction to the legislature. This is direction to the Healthcare Access Commission to give them kind of a timeline of what kind of plan that we would like to see them develop to bring back to the legislature.
That's current law.
Mr. Chair? I understand that. I understand that it's current law, but I'm and Mr. Chair, maybe it slipped by me the last time, but I'm just wondering if we generally put goal. But if it's directed at the Healthcare Acts or the Legislative Commission, or I guess I.
Sir Fishbach, it probably didn't slip. I think it came before your time when this was put in. Statute,
okay.
So you didn't miss it.
Okay.
Senator Higgins.
I can't find it.
Mr. Chair, thank Senator you. Berglund, the Healthcare Access Commission was the commission that helped us create Minnesota Care. Is that correct?
It was.
And if so, is it still active? Who's on it? I haven't heard much about it actually working these days.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Higgins, it's a statutory legislative commission. Members have been appointed every biennium. It is a commission that is co-chaired by a legislator from the House and a legislator from the Senate. And it hasn't met recently, because Representative Bradley and I agreed that we couldn't come up with a common agenda. But now we believe that that the group will be able to come up with common agenda items, and we'll be meeting. The members are appointed by the through the process that the House and Senate each have for appointing members to commissions, and we expect that the members of this group will be appointed sometime in the month of February.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, are you and your companion House Committee Chair the chairs of this commission?
Usually.
Okay.
But it is it is a selection process by the members of the commission.
Okay. Senator Berglund, I'm going to suggest, because of time, that we cut off the introduction now, and I will ask members if they could help the staff by putting their amendments and the bill in their packets, and ask members if it would be helpful if we would have staff put an informal engrossment, so delete everything so you can read it all as one. That would be helpful.
Yay. Absolutely.
We will have that done by when we take up the bill next, which I believe will be Monday. Is there further discussion or questions for right now? If not, with that, we'll set the bill aside till Monday, and the meeting is adjourned.
Oh, someone handed me a note.
Did you find your
envelope? Oh, put their things in the packets.
They're all, but I did steal Debbie Johnson.
What did you want?
I'm taking this with me, and I put mine back in here, so you'll just have to replace her.
So we're expecting to have it on the 15th. So I look forward to hearing.